Hello and welcome to episode 265 of AvTalk. I am Ian Pechnik, here as always with
Jason Rabinowitz. No time for pleasantries today, Ian. We've got a lot to cover. Not a lot of time. Let's get to it.
Well, we've got a great show today. Jason and I are probably off on looking at the show notes. Maybe we have two or three good rants in us. And we also have a fantastic conversation with Scott Bateman, who is currently a pilot for a large UK airline, but that's not what we're talking about with him. He has written a new book called Hercules, First In, Last Out, the story of an RAF legend. As a former Hercules captain, he knows a bit about the aircraft. So we're going to chat with him a little bit later in the show, and stick around for information on how you can win a copy of the book.
Hey, we don't have many giveaways. That's good.
No, we don't. That's nice. But we're going with a great book. I've read the book. It's fantastic. So we'll talk more about that later in the show. But we go back to Jason's backyard first to start the show and talk about another not so good situation, this time at JFK, where Swiss Flight 17 decided that it was going to abort its takeoff roll after the pilots noticed not one, not two, not three, but four other aircraft crossing their runway as they were on the takeoff roll. That's not good.
No, that's not good. The way JFK works in many configurations, well, two configurations, really, you have two parallel runways, 2-2-4, and in this configuration, they were operating, I believe, on the fours. So you had aircraft that were coming in that were landing parallel to aircraft that were taking off on the adjacent runway. What happens when these aircraft land? They make a left turn off the runway. I'm sorry, I think this was actually on operating on the fours, but they make a left off the runway and they stagger on different taxiways to cross the active departure runway. They'll often queue up and wait for kind of a break for the departures, and then air traffic controllers will clear a bunch of aircraft at the same time to cross the runway while a departure. If there's a line of departure, departure will hold, or if there's no aircraft waiting to go, that's great. But that doesn't usually happen during rush hour at JFK. There's always an aircraft waiting to take off. In this case, there was a miscommunication in the air traffic control cab where, unfortunately, the way it works is that once the aircraft arrive and they move off the runway that they landed on, they are transitioned from the tower to the ground frequency. So then you have these four aircraft that are being cleared to cross runway 4 left by the ground controller. And at the same time, the tower controller cleared the Swiss aircraft to take off in obviously conflict with the other four aircraft. And thankfully, in this case, the Swiss pilots were able to see what was happening in front of them, because we know oftentimes we've seen in the past that that is not always the case. And they were able to stop, get off the runway, turn around and take off again from an intersection to not have to go back to the gate to refuel if they had to wait in line again. But this is extremely, extremely concerning. There was a lot of back and forth after this on the social medias about how it's more or less unique to the US, where you'll have aircraft crossing an active runway that are not on the tower frequency, they're on ground. So you have pilots that are operating their aircraft that just landed that are not on the same frequency as the aircraft that are about to take off. So they can't really hear what's going on with these other aircraft. And in this case, there was a lack of coordination or a breakdown of some sort in the FAA air traffic control tower that cleared aircraft to take off at the same time that these aircraft are being cleared to cross the runway. Thankfully, the absolute last line of defense in this case, which is the pilots of that Swiss aircraft seeing conflicting traffic, worked, and they stopped their aircraft safely and they were able to take off again. But in an alternate reality, it was foggy or it was rainy or they were distracted by something else and they didn't see these other aircraft, or there's too many lights, a lot of blinking things at JFK, and this could have ended differently. This is not getting the same level of attention that the American versus Delta incident also at JFK, also including the same exact runway last year, where we saw the FAA and the NTSB get involved and there was a lot of attention. This one doesn't seem to be getting that attention. I haven't seen anything come out from the FAA or the NTSB, but in my opinion, this incident is way worse because it was not caught by air traffic control. It was caught by the pilots on the ground, which is the absolute last line of defense.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, they caught it early. The top speed that we recorded for the Swiss A330 was 37 knots. So they had just begun the takeoff roll when they noticed what was happening. And I'm looking at the playback, and I'll put a link to the playback, but also a link to a photo of our tracking, because it's four aircraft crossing the runway at the same time. It's like a race to get across the runway as there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 aircraft lined up ready to depart. So, I mean, it's fast moving stuff, and you've got a Delta 767 and three other aircraft crossing the runway at the exact same time. And Swiss says, no, we're not going to do this. It's just, I mean, it's really, really incredible to me that there wasn't coordination there. I mean,
typically there is coordination because you have the ground controller and the tower controller sitting next to each other, presumably. So they're coordinating these things. And in this case, there was a breakdown of some sort of coordination, which is not great. My bigger concern is that air traffic controllers didn't catch it, that the pilot of this Swiss flight one of the pilots had to catch this, which isn't always going to happen every time for all the reasons we mentioned earlier. There's got to be something that can be done with this. I know that this is standard operation at JFK. This is how it works, unfortunately, the layout of the aircraft. It's not like somewhere like O'Hare where you have a runaround taxiway where they don't have to cross an active runway to get to the gates. Here, you do. And like you said, Ian, there are four aircraft all crossing at the same time. That's standard. That's how it works at JFK. They got to get to the gate somehow. They all stack up and then they go at the same time. So you don't have constant disruption. But man, something has got to change. I don't know what kind of computer automation, I don't want to say AI, or something that will prevent conflicting authorizations like this to have aircraft cleared to take off, but also cleared to cross the active runway at the same time. It's not great. It reminds me of like a railway signal system. Like you cannot have two trains cleared to go through the same switch or diverge through the same track at the same time because the signals interlock. Only one can be green at the same time. You can't have two trains doing the same thing at the same time. But in aviation, it's much more, well, the air traffic controller's got it in his head or her head, and they're going to keep them separated in their mind. And in this case, unfortunately, that broke down pretty significantly.
Yeah. The air traffic controllers, however, did catch a possible runway incursion incident between, well, actually technically it isn't a runway incursion because they were across the stop bars, between JetBlue and Southwest at National Airport in Washington, D.C. the next day. A JetBlue flight was departing while a Southwest flight was taxiing out to the other runway, and the JetBlue flight had begun its takeoff roll. Southwest was cleared to cross runway 4 and was doing so when it was told to stop, and JetBlue was told to stop again. Fortunately, both aircraft were not moving at a high rate of speed. JetBlue only got up to about 30 knots again. Southwest was taxiing below that, so they were able to easily stop in time. But another incident we're adding to the list.
Yeah, and I think the JetBlue flight did go back to the gate for whatever reason.
Yes.
Apparently, the runway JetBlue was taking off on isn't commonly used. That's runway 4 at DCA is not commonly used for departures because it's pretty short. So perhaps there was some sort of confusion because it's not a typical operation at DCA. So maybe it tripped up one of the controllers. But this is two fairly significant events. Was it the same day or back-to-back days?
Back-to-back.
Back-to-back
days. One after the other. Yeah.
So it brings up the topic of conversation of, are there more runway incursions happening? Or are we more in tune to what's happening and they're getting more attention now than they would have in the past? And I think the answer to that is it doesn't matter whether it's happening more now or we're paying more attention to it now because the media is paying more attention to it now. I think the same answer is the result here, that something needs to be done, that we have room for improvement. There is clear room for improvement here. And whether or not that's just because incursions are happening at a higher rate or we're just hearing about it more, I don't think that's relevant. It's being exposed. It's being made public. And something needs to change because these events, at least in my eyes, they are happening too frequently. And I don't think it matters if it happened this frequently in 2019 versus 2024. Any amount is too much, and there's always room for improvement.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that aviation safety is iterative, and there's no reason to, I mean, because statistically speaking, things aren't necessarily happening more often. They're, in this case, just more notable. And so I think, to Jason's point, who cares? Let's solve the problem.
Fix it.
Let's fix this.
Yeah, well, let's say you might not be able to fix it, but you might be able to reduce it. And that should always be the goal.
Yeah, you can improve. One of the ways that can possibly improve aviation safety is giving air traffic controllers more rest. And that's what a new rule is set to do, announced the 19th of April and scheduled to go into effect within 90 days. This new rule by the FAA will give air traffic controllers a minimum of 12 hours rest prior to starting a midnight shift. So that's any shift where the bulk of the shift happens between 2:30 in the morning and 6:30 in the morning local time. Interestingly.
Yeah, and it's up to 10 hours now, up from a minimum of 8 for a normal shift. Because if anyone's ever worked a regular job listening to this podcast, 8 hours between shift is not a lot. You should be getting anywhere from 7 to 8 hours of sleep every day. I don't see how you could possibly do that if you only have 8 hours off between actual shifts. So this is an obvious improvement to help overcome fatigue. And I don't know, maybe it will lead to a few less runway incursions. That could be good. But this will come at a cost. And Ian, what is that cost?
So one of the interesting things is that the Air Traffic Controllers Association, NATCA, is worried that it might actually lead to more overtime and fatigue, because the union says that the FAA hasn't really given a rationale for why they're laying this out the way they are, and they aren't aware of any studies about how they're actually going to plan for this rest based on the number of controllers they have, because the FAA is woefully understaffed as far as air traffic controllers are concerned. So the controllers are worried that by giving these shifts more rest, they're going to create coverage holes, which will lead to more overtime for other controllers and won't really solve the fatigue problem, which is, I guess, a well-founded concern, and also not great. The FAA, for its part, says that its goal is to hire 1,800 controllers this year, up from 1,500 last year. So that will hopefully help. But as we've talked with air traffic controllers in the past, not necessarily on the show, but for the show, one of the things that they point out too is that, you know, training to be an air traffic controller takes an incredible amount of time, and training to be an effective air traffic controller takes an even longer amount of time. So new hires is good, necessary, wonderful to see.
But you don't put new hires at JFK or LAX. It takes time to get to that point.
Right. And you have to have people that want to work there.
That's also true. Maybe this would have been better if it had some triggers saying, okay, the 10 to 12 hour shift rule will go into effect when we have 80% air traffic controller staffing met or something like that. Putting it into effect within 90 days, that's going to hit right in the peak of summer. And if there are not enough air traffic controllers, and we know there are not, this is going to have consequences. It is good that they are being given the time off between shifts that they definitely need. 8 hours is not sufficient for anyone to be doing anything of this caliber of work. But it doesn't really seem all that well thought out. And I feel like we're going to be talking about this come 90 days from when the day was announced.
We'll see what happens this summer.
Coming soon. This summer.
Let's shift gears and talk about money, or the lack thereof in this case. As we're in earnings season and Boeing reported its first quarter earnings and their profit, or lack thereof, they lost $355 million in the first quarter. But, Jason, that's an improvement year over year.
Hey.
Where they lost even more money in the first quarter of last year, where they lost $425 million.
Wow.
Boeing says that it generated $16.6 billion in revenue during the first 3 months of this year, but that figure is down 8% from last year. So Dave Calhoun, talking about the earnings, said that the first quarter results are indicative of the 737 rate slowdown, taking more time to ensure that the aircraft is actually assembled fully before it is shipped off to customers, and also indicative of how much compensation that Boeing has paid to a variety of customers for the 737-9 grounding. So not a great first quarter for Boeing, not a ton of orders, only 125 commercial aircraft orders during the first quarter. That included the 85 MAX 10s for American Airlines, which are still yet uncertified. Also mystery customers for the 777X, including Ethiopian Airlines and a customer to be named eventually.
Ah, the old Petchmoware order.
Exactly. Far too new for Petchmoware. Sticking with Boeing, Boeing is set to provide $425 million to Spirit Air Systems in advance payments as it tries to keep them afloat. They announced that yesterday that the money from Boeing will address Spirit's higher levels of inventory because Boeing is finishing fewer 737s and give it some cash to keep on moving through. Spirit is set to be acquired by Boeing eventually. The negotiations are ongoing. And really what's holding this all up is the fact that Spirit also does work for Airbus and they have to figure out how to sell that off as best they can before Boeing can retake Spirit.
Yeah, whatever short-term gains there were for spinning off Spirit, they are certainly coming back to bite Boeing in the behind and then some. I'd love for someone to run those numbers. We should get Gavin back on the podcast one of these days to see what did Boeing gain all those years ago for spinning off Spirit versus what they're losing now. What was the final outcome of that? Oof.
All right.
Those are numbers above my and your head, I think.
Yes, absolutely. There's also the fact that late last night, John Ostrower at the Air Current reported that Boeing has retaken delivery, custody, I think was the phrase that John used.
A delivery
of the 737 MAX 9 that suffered the door plug blowout for Alaska Airlines. So Alaska Airlines no longer owns that aircraft, apparently.
Interesting. And yeah, they clarified that we don't want this on our hands anymore because it's taking our mechanics time to go keep it airworthy and keep it up to date and all that. So make it Boeing's problem. So our mechanics can do things like keeping our planes that actually work and are, you know, possibly evidence in a criminal prosecution on the ground. Because apparently, we've talked about this before, it is not an easy task to keep an aircraft on the ground and airworthy because they want to be flying. So make it Boeing's problem. I think that's a great idea.
And while we're talking about Alaska, Alaska lost $132 million in the first quarter. And the airline says that's all down to the fact that it had to park a bunch of its 737 MAX 9s.
Whoops.
So without that, they would have made a profit, but they didn't.
I think the same goes for United. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there was a material impact to its earnings as well because of the damn 7 MAX 9 grounding.
Yep. We can just go back to last week's episode when we talked about that one. So airlines definitely impacted by the grounding. Let's go over to Europe and talk about the fact that some pilots are set for a £35,000 pay raise, but the union says, we think there's more money here.
Ah.
EasyJet pilots are set to vote on a pay increase, or they're going to get the offer that they'll then have to vote on, that will hike captains' salaries. So longtime captains. So if you've been captain basically the longest, up to £200,000. This is a £35,000 pay raise. First officers would see their pay rise from £93,000 to £112,000. This would all go into effect next year. Those are senior first officers. And then other first officers would see their pay rise from £62,000 to £75,000. BALPA, the British Airline Pilots Association, leaders recommend that rank and file accept it. However, it seems like that will be rejected because they see that the airline can offer more. The airline is doing this to keep their pilots from jumping ship.
Interesting. Okay. I guess there's still a pilot shortage over in the UK?
There certainly is.
Okay.
So this is definitely a move to keep their pilots from going to BA, from going to Virgin, where they could make ostensibly make more money, although now they wouldn't. They're going to make quite a bit more, except for long-time BA captains, which is, I mean, it's pretty incredible to me, to the lengths that a lot of these airlines are going to keep their pilots. So it'll be interesting to see if they accept the offer or if it's rejected. And if it's rejected, what EasyJet comes back with? Because I can only imagine that things could get rather acrimonious if this goes on too long.
Go get that money. If there's money on the table to be had, go get it.
There you go. Speaking of money on the table, the Department of Transportation issued new rules for getting your money back if your airplane gets stuck under a table. I think I took that transition too far. But yeah, Jason, what's going on?
One step too far. So depending on who you are and who you ask and where you are on the political spectrum, this is either the best thing to come out of the DOT in a long time or the worst thing that has ever happened in the history of humankind. So consumer protection in the US is kind of not a thing. We don't really do that here.
That seems a wide berth.
It is a wide berth, but that's when there's 1,000 retweets, you're going to get some spicy takes.
Never read the comments, Jason.
Never read the replies, but I read some of the replies and they're a little unhinged, a couple of them. But consumer protection is not our thing in the US. So anytime consumer protection is enacted, people react weirdly. Like, I don't know what the deal is. But basically what the DOT proposed here, not proposed, the proposal happened in like 2016. This is a long time in the coming. And what we finally got today was the final rule. If a flight in the US is delayed, a domestic flight is delayed more than 3 hours, you are now due a refund of your fare, not a voucher, not a coupon, a cash refund to your form of payment. So back to your credit, debit, or I guess presumably cash if you paid a walk-up fare in cash. An international flight would be over 6 hours. So if your international flight is delayed over 6 hours, you are eligible for a refund. And in some cases here, there will be automatic refunds. So you won't have to wade through an airline's website or call and wait on hold for 17 hours to get someone who just hangs up on you. The refund process will be a lot smoother. But there's also the potential for some unwanted refunds. The word automatic here plays a lot into when exactly this refund happens. In the case that either a passenger declines alternate transportation or the airline apparently decides there is no other way to get you from A to B, apparently the refund process can automatically be triggered. And I think that's going to prove problematic rather quickly. It's probably going to be an edge case, but there are cases where Allegiant operates, let's say, one flight a week to an airport that there are no other flights to. If that cancels and they say, well, sorry, there's no other way we can get you there. There's no alternative. So we're canceling your flight and we're refunding your money. That doesn't get you home if you're, you know, in Cancun and you're looking to get back to, I don't know, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and there's no other flight. Getting a refund doesn't really help you. You're still in Cancun and there are worse places to be, but I could foresee some problems. But the spirit of this is good, that it will make it easier and better to get refunds for flights that are significantly delayed or canceled. It does not go anywhere near as far as the EU does with the EU 261 compensation. This is not a fine. It's not a penalty. You don't get rewarded for an airline being late. This is simply a refund on your full flight or your whatever portion of your itinerary you have not yet used, which honestly, why wasn't that always the case? Who wants a non-transferable 90-day expiring credit to Spirit if your flight's canceled? That's not helpful.
There's got to be somebody out there.
Not me. Basically, this is just airlines must provide you with a cash refund instead of a voucher, unless you want a voucher. By all means, you can take one. The airline would be thrilled.
The other aspect of this is if vouchers might be worth a lot more now.
Well, yeah, if there's a delay or cancellation, the airline, and this is already the case for some airlines, they have the power to do this. They'll say, if you move off this flight, we'll give you, you know, like $75. But if you want it in credit, we'll give you like $500 because they're playing with house money. It doesn't matter at that point. In a lot of cases, it makes sense to take the credit because if it doesn't expire for like a full year and it's triple, quadruple the value, I'm going to take the credit if I know I'm going to fly that airline again, as long as it doesn't have strings attached like Spirit where you got to use it in 90 days because that's just rude.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to chat with Scott Bateman about his new book that is due out soon, Hercules, First In, Last Out, the story of an RAF legend. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are now joined by Scott Bateman, who is currently a commercial pilot for a large UK-based airline flying the Airbus. And we've got him on today to not talk about that, which is highly unusual for us because we don't talk all that much about non-commercial aviation. But Scott has a new book out called Hercules. It's about, you guessed it, the Hercules. He's also a former RAF Hercules captain, and he's put together a collection of incredible stories about the aircraft and the people who fly it. Scott, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Hercules today.
Ian, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. Glad I can share it with everyone.
So the book is not out yet. It's out 23rd May in the UK and the 23rd August in the US. Though, Scott, you mentioned by quirk, you can pre-order it in the UK for very low prices right now on Amazon and basically have it shipped anywhere in the world. So if you want the book as soon as you can have it, it seems that's the way to go.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? The quirk of Amazon pricing at the moment is that it's 50% off in the UK for the hardback, which makes it £10, 10 of our British pounds. And somebody yesterday told me on X that it was cheaper to buy it in the UK and have it shipped to New Zealand than to buy it in New Zealand for release in August, which seems ridiculous.
There you go.
But it is what it is.
So I've had a chance to read an advance copy, which I'm very grateful for, because it's a fascinating, fascinating book. It takes us through not only your career in the RAF with the airplane, and we'll get to that in a minute, but it takes us through kind of the history of the aircraft itself. And there were so many things in here that I didn't know about the aircraft itself, and I didn't know about what the aircraft and its crews have done. And so that's kind of where I want to start the conversation is let's talk about how the book came about and how you were able to put some of these things in here. Because from my understanding, some of this stuff has never been written about before, at least in outside of government reports.
I'll say that a lot of these stories have never been told outside of government reports and perhaps some media speculation. The book started when we realized that the RAF Hercules was going to go out of service. They were going to retire the Hercules from RAF service and replace it with the Airbus, the A400M. Very sad occasion and, you know, a huge legacy, 47 Squadron in particular, which is the focus of a lot of the stories in the book, has an amazing operational record from 1960s onward. And all of those stories, really, as the squadron was disbanding, as the aircraft went out of service, we thought they're going to be lost. These stories are just going to wither on the vine. People are going to die. Perhaps, you know, some of these guys who were around in the 60s. So now is the time to capture it as the aircraft's going out of service. And in the 70th year of continuous production of the airplane, you know, it's a record-breaking year of 70 years of continuous production. Let's bring the book out and let's tell some of these stories that have never been told before.
I've heard from people when they're dealing with previously classified information and dealing with, you know, trying to get things published, that it's often a long slog. Did you find that, you know, there was a lot of resistance, or were people really keen to kind of help tell the story of the aircraft?
I think the individuals, the crews, there is always a reluctance to tell stories because nobody thinks they've been heroic. You know, it's the day job. So trying to pull some of the stories out of the crews was easy, some of them not so easy. And the challenge that we do have is a lot of this was classified, you know, at the time, and some of it is still classified. So we've had to adapt some of the stories, remove some of the names, change some of the names and locations. Not to lose the feel of the story, but to just protect some of the individuals that are still there. And the book had to be cleared by the Ministry of Defence because we're talking about operations that, you know, some in 1960s, which actually are still classified today, particularly some around the Falklands in the 80s. And then as we come closer to, you know, some of the last operations in Khartoum, which the book ends with, you know, those individuals are still serving, and we've got to protect their anonymity in a way that is appropriate. So it has been a toil. It's taken months for the Ministry of Defence to clear it. But we've ended up with this amazing book of stories, compendium of about 24, 25 stories, which really I don't think have ever been told outside RAF bars, and people pulling up a sandbag.
I will say that RAF bars are a major theme in the book. And a lot of the book comes back to conversations that happen in RAF bars after something quite harrowing has occurred. So, the story about an army marching on its stomach, I think the army, also drinking has a lot to do with this. But there were a couple other themes that I wanted to pull out. And one of the things that I've found fascinating throughout the book was kind of the discovery by necessity of the capability of the aircraft, where crews were learning what the Hercules could do, not because it had been designed to do that. And then, it was written down somewhere in the checklist said, okay, we can do this. It was, here's the job that we have to do. Now we need to figure out how to make sure that the airplane can do it. And I was fascinated by that throughout the book.
Yeah, I think there are two real standouts for me in terms of that. One would be obviously the Falklands campaign, where by necessity, it's a long way from the UK to the Falklands. They had to literally, on the back of a cigarette packet, design and install an air-to-air refueling system for the airplane to allow them to be airborne refueled to get down to the Falklands and back to drop stores to the ships. There are a couple of stories about that in particular in the book. And then the more famous one is obviously the raid on Entebbe, where the Israeli Defense Forces used Hercules to rescue the hostages on the airfield in Entebbe. First time they'd used night vision goggles. In fact, the first time that some of the pilots had even seen night vision goggles was when they pushed off on this amazing aviation raid, flown in, a formation of Hercules down to Entebbe. It rescued all of the hostages without any hostage deaths, actually, during the raid. And there was only one IDF soldier who sadly died during that. Benjamin Netanyahu's brother actually died during the raid. So, those having to innovate by necessity to meet a tactical need or tactical operational need has been a theme, as you say, throughout the entire book. And the crews have been amazing at innovating and bringing solutions that actually that the airplane, when it was built, I don't think anyone envisaged what it would be doing in, never mind the 1980s, but what it was doing just before it left RAF service in 2023.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fascinating, there's so many fascinating things in here, but just the ability of the aircraft to kind of just have things bolted onto it. I mean, you mentioned the air-to-air refueling. We're going to put a link to a photo in the show notes of X-ray Victor 200, which is one of the first Hercules from the RAF to be fitted with air-to-air refueling. And when you look at it, it's literally just a probe with a pipe bolted to the outside of the aircraft.
Yeah, and the pipe went back directly into the wing tank, basically, and it had a little valve that the flight engineer worked to make it work. And the really bizarre thing about the air-to-air refueling probe on the early Hercules was that it sat almost directly above the co-pilot's head. So actually, when the captain was flying the aircraft and trying to put the probe into the drogue for air-to-air refueling, they couldn't actually look at it. So there was that kind of parallax where they had to focus on the airplane ahead and listen to what the co-pilot was saying in terms of left and right and forward and back. So you couldn't actually look at it, because if you looked at it, you would tend to lean away and miss the basket just because of the parallax. So it wasn't ideal when they designed it, but it did the job and it lasted a very, very long time.
The other thing about the air-to-air refueling story was how they had to do it at first with the descending refueling. Can you explain that to me?
Oh, so tobogganing, it was called. It's a simple challenge of aerodynamics. So the Victor tanker, the Handy Page Victor, which was a V bomber, started out as a bomber aircraft, nuclear bomber, was converted to be a tanker aircraft. Now, if you can imagine nuclear bomber, V-shaped wing, it was quite a slick airplane. This airplane didn't go very slow when it was flying. So the slowest speed of the Victor was actually greater than the cruising speed of the Hercules. you've now got a problem. You've got a tanker that goes quicker, even at its lowest speed, than the receiver. So what you had to do was you had to plug in the receiver in a dive so that essentially the tanker is diving with its speed brake out to keep it going slower, and the Herc is diving to gather speed plugged in. And, you know, you'd start this at, I think, you know, up in the region of about 25,000 feet, and you'd hope that you got all the fuel on board by the time you get down to, well, in some cases, as you read in the book, not a lot.
Not a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So they'd still be tanking, you know, sometimes very low, particularly over the water, before they get enough fuel to be able to allow them to unplug and climb back up. And this was a one-shot deal, really. You know, the tanker, you had to stay plugged in to get all of that fuel in one shot, one toboggan, as they called it. Yeah, so it was a bit of a hairy thing. Never done it myself. You know, it sounds utterly bizarre.
The other thing that kind of comes throughout the book is that the aircraft, I mean, we see the crews kind of inventing ways to get around tactical challenges, but the aircraft kind of morphs out of, and this is something that kind of comes across, I think, in the stories from the crews who flew the aircraft, where they're being asked to do things and the government's saying, oh, no, that's fine. You'll be fine. It's not combat. Totally fine. You don't need additional protections and for combat aircraft. And they're going, no, we're being asked to fly into a war zone here. It would be nice to have a bit more here. The role of the aircraft really changed as the capabilities become evident that this aircraft can actually do a lot more than we thought it could.
Yeah, and I think that becomes really evident in some of the stories around the Gulf War in particular, where, you know, we bought this airplane as a transport airplane. It was effectively going to be a removals van. This was there to remove stuff around the battlefield or to remove it between theaters. That was all we were ever going to use this for. And then, you know, in the sort of the 60s and 70s, it became really apparent that, as you say, that this had a role in supporting specialist troops, particularly, you know, in niche capabilities. So as those roles grew, this airplane went from one that was operating behind the lines, i.e. behind the line of your own troops, to one that was actually spearheading and going ahead and inserting specialist troops behind enemy lines, supporting them behind enemy lines, you know, and really pushing a long way forward with its fast jet counterparts. Hence the subtitle of the book is, you know, First In, Last Out. And, you know, we saw that in Afghanistan in particular. You know, the first aircraft into Afghanistan was a Hercules post 9/11. And actually the last one to leave the Royal Air Force was also a Hercules. And that's been fairly consistent throughout the Hercules' life, particularly in the Royal Air Force, you know, supporting those niche troops, as we'll call them.
So you served on the Hercules in three roles, if I'm remembering correctly. And what were those?
So I started off my career as a loadmaster back in 1990. I wasn't quite good enough then to be a pilot. And the Air Force were right. I wasn't really mature enough, I don't think, back then. And then in 1997, I went from being sergeant aircrew to commissioning and becoming a pilot and coming back to the squadron I'd just left, which was 47 Squadron. And I served there as a co-pilot and a captain.
What about the aircraft to you is special and important as someone who's spent a lot of time in the back and in the front?
It's forgiving. This is an amazing airplane. You know, it has a straight wing. It flies really well. It goes slow. It lifts a lot. It stops really quick. You can land it in someone's back garden on the grass if you really wanted to. It's an airplane that, and I describe it all the time as it's the Swiss Army knife of airplanes. You know, if you've got a job you need doing, the Herc can probably do it. You know, everything from, as we've said, aeromedical evacuations, famine relief, firefighting, even drops the biggest conventional weapon in the world, the MOAB. You know, so it can do a lot of damage as well as saving lives. It's an amazing airplane. And for me, it was my first command, other than, you know, light aircraft. So it holds a special place in my heart because of that. But also, I spent a lot of time in it, you know, going across the world, doing some amazing things with amazing people, people who, you know, today are still friends. And it's not just about the machine, it's also about the people who fly the machine.
One of the things that struck me about the book is the closeness of the squadron over time. And the book does a good job of kind of containing some narratives. So you don't get, I guess, the full picture of how these people interact over time. But I was really impressed by how tight that squadron remains over such a long period of time. And that really, you know, shines through in some of the more tragic stories that you tell. And I was really moved by that. And first of all, how few there have been, which is truly impressive, but how when those things do happen, there's a real sense of community.
We sometimes describe work as our work family, don't we? As colleagues at work as our work family. I think when you're exposed to extremes with people from your work family, you're going to war with them. You're living in their pocket for months on end. You form a bond that I don't think you would get in any workplace other than the one that we worked in. And those bonds stick together for a very long time. You know, people who I joined with in 1990, I'm still in contact almost on a daily basis with. And I don't think if you joined a corporate environment in 1990, you would still have as many of those friendships as we all do. And I think what happens is when people within that environment sadly are lost, and as you say, we had two very specific tragedies, one due to enemy action, one that was shot down in Iraq, and one that was a training accident in Scotland. Now, when those things happen, they hit the family pretty hard. And, you know, still today, those incidents in particular still hit the squadron family and obviously the Bree family is pretty hard.
Your treatment of the subject is engrossing because you do focus a lot on the aviation aspect of it. And I think that's a really important component of it. But the people really shine through and the strength of the people really shine through. And I appreciated that. The book collates, 60 some odd years of history into great collection of stories, and absolutely pick up a copy and read all the way through it. But Scott, from what I hear, there are more stories to come. So we're looking forward to that and whatever you do next. We've been chatting with Scott Bateman, who is currently a pilot for a UK-based airline, a former RAF Hercules captain, and the book is called Hercules, First In, Last Out, The Story of an RAF Legend, available the 23rd of May in the UK for pre-order now for shipping worldwide for cheap, apparently, on Amazon. And it's available everywhere else in the US and other places, the 23rd of August of this year. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Ian, thanks for having me on. And I'll look forward to coming back and telling you a little bit about the next project. I think that one will be cracking and your listeners will love that one even more.
Absolutely. Looking forward to having you back soon. Welcome back. I am thoroughly excited about Scott's book, so much so that we're going to give away a copy if you don't want to rush out and buy one on your own. If you do want to be entered to win a copy of Scott's book, email us at podcast@fr24.com with your name, where you want us to send you the book, and say, hey, I want to win the book. And we'll do a random drawing of all the entries and we'll send you a copy of Scott's book, Hercules. It's really, really good. And I hope you got that out of the conversation with Scott, but definitely check that out. And if you say, hey, I don't want to win a copy, I want to buy one as soon as possible, then go ahead and do that as well. Or enter the contest to get another copy and then you can give it to a friend.
We love a good giveaway. We should do that more often.
We should do that more often. All right. Good idea. You know what's not a great idea, Jason?
Shining really, really bright halogen lights in a really concentrated part of 1A321 or 3787s to the point where the windows melt.
That is,
yeah, I kind of gave the whole thing away.
A good idea.
Yeah.
So the UK AIB report,
which I didn't know we were getting. I thought we were done with this story.
No, that was just a preliminary report. This is a final report, and it includes pictures.
Lots of pictures.
And you'll learn a lot about lighting and film and all sorts of good fun stuff. It's not just an aviation safety report, but it is in fact an aviation safety report. And I want to absolutely mention the fact that the final report was flagged to us by a podcast listener. So thank you for that, sending over the link and letting us know that that report had come out. So we all know what happened. Very, very powerful halogen lamps placed too close to the aircraft, melted the sealant around the windows and some of the acrylic, deformed the windows, and that led to excess cabin noise. The engineer that was on board this flight leaving London said, "Hey, it's really loud in here," went to look at it, saw that the window wasn't where it was supposed to be. They turned the aircraft around and landed safely. And then when they investigated things, they said, "Oh, none of this looks the way it's supposed to," because they had shown very, very powerful halogen lamps, and it had distorted the acrylic and the foam sealant around the windows. Nothing was ever coming directly into the cabin because the inner window pane was not affected, but it wouldn't have been good flying across the Atlantic for many, many hours on that. The final report by the AAIB also lists one A321 and four 787s that had been impacted by this previously, which is something that we knew it had been, there had been previous impacts to aircraft, but we didn't know it was that many. And we didn't know that the 787 was so outsized in the sample size. Boeing sent out a Fleet Team Digest article in 2020 citing three of the events where damage was caused because of these lights. And Airbus, following this event, sent out a message to operators as well. None of these others required accident investigation reports because they all happened on the ground and were noticed before the aircraft flew again. So they were just repaired and put back into flight.
Yeah, I love that one of the recommendations from the AAIB is like, hey, maybe use LED lights next time so that they're not so hot and melt your airplane, which is
yeah, I mean, good advice. It's actually really interesting like how they discuss how the lights work and their intensity and their effects at various ranges. I mean, if you want to geek out on this a lot, you can. I mean, we talk about thermal conductivity, there are charts and graphs and spectral analyses.
It's all pretty great stuff. I ran this by my friend from NYC Aviation, Ben Granucci. This is like the complete intersection of his interests.
This is a Venn diagram of his interests.
Lighting and aviation. And he said, yeah, LEDs are just starting to get to the point where they're an option for something like this. I didn't know that you couldn't use LED lights for lighting an aircraft and simulating, I think it was a sunrise or a sunset like this. I had assumed literally everything was LED at this point, was the de facto standard, but apparently not. But this particular lighting company or production company learned the hard way why they may want to look at it a little harder next time.
Yeah. We'll put a link in the show notes to that report. Worth reading if you like airplanes, if you like lights, and if you like airplanes with lights. Also, the pictures are pretty astonishing what happens to a window.
Some pretty melty windows. Yeah, it's great.
You can definitely melt some acrylic. We also have a preliminary report from the Chilean investigators on LATAM Flight 800, which was flying between Australia and New Zealand and then on its way back to Chile, where we now have confirmation of what happened, which is whoever was standing behind the captain's seat pressed the move seat button. It moved the captain and the captain's seat into the control column. Control column was pressed down, and the aircraft descended 400 feet.
Hmm. Case closed.
Yeah. So there's some interesting photography of what that switch looks like and why it looks maybe not the way it's supposed to on this particular aircraft, but not too much new information. I did get to brush up on my Spanish. FYI, the report is in Spanish, so you'll either need to know Spanish or know how to use Google Translate. But we'll put a link in the show notes there. Jason,
yo,
update me on your electric beaver.
Ah, well, it's not my electric beaver, unfortunately. It's Harbor Air's electric beaver out in Vancouver. They have announced that they will convert 50, I believe, of their De Havilland Canada DHC-2 Beaver aircraft to all electric, which is pretty fascinating. They have had the E-plane 1.0 prototype, as it's been called, operating for a number of years, though, I think even before COVID. Interestingly, it's only logged 78 flights since then. And now it's been in, and I quote, for some architecture updates, which I guess is what you do with a prototype. You evolve it and you go from 1.0 to 2.0. But apparently they have liked it enough that they are converting all of their DHC2 Beavers to electric. And they will also make their plans, their conversion available to other operators, which I think is really cool. Yeah.
That's great. I hope to fly in one soon.
I hope to too. Every time I go to Vancouver, I'm upset that I don't see this aircraft somewhere. I would very much like to go on a flight operated by this electric Beaver, just because it's fun to say electric Beaver.
It's a great turn of phrase. I'm enjoying it. Great. Let's stay north of the border from us. And last week we talked about a heist in Toronto. Now, what happened in Montreal?
Well, Montreal is where you might find the International Civil Aviation Organization. Apparently, I don't know if this is months or years ago, a couple of employees of the organization decided they wanted to sell some illegal contraband because there are sanctions in place, and they wanted to sell things like drones to Syria using, I think, UN-operated flights. Basically, they were operating or wanted to. I don't know if they ever actually overtly took that step to operate this ring, but under the guise of the organization and the UN, they were going to smuggle in contraband to Syria. And apparently the Royal Canadian Mounted Police did not take kindly to that. And a couple of guys here, actually one of them has been arrested. The other, there is a warrant out for his arrest. Who knows where he is now? But something going on in Canada. This is 2 weeks in a row where we're getting aviation industry professionals here arrested due to either smuggling goods or stealing all of the gold. It's very interesting up in Canada right now.
So this happened a few years ago. Jason, I'm going to give a small correction to what Jason said. It was Libya, not Syria.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. The press release they put out did not specify. You have to go elsewhere to find out the juicy details.
So these were two former employees of ICAO working in Montreal, and they were trying to buy Chinese drones and other military equipment and get them to Libya. And just, I mean, an incredible concoction of ideas. Again, Jason mentioned it's unclear whether or not they actually did any of this, but they were trying to do bad things. And so ICAO says it's cooperating with the investigation. So hopefully we'll learn more next week after some court appearances, and hopefully they catch the other guy so we can.
Yeah, RCMP's got their hands full with aviation shenanigans these days.
Busy Mounties. Let's go in the opposite direction now and talk about Oakland International Airport, or soon to be San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport.
Maybe. I'm all for it. I'm absolutely for this. So apparently, Oakland International Airport wants to rename to San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport. But the other airport across that bay, SFO, San Francisco Airport, says, no, you can't do that. That's our name. We're going to sue you to stop you from changing your name. I don't like this. Oakland, as a cranky flyer, Brett Snyder has a good write-up on this that we'll link to, has a very good article or blog post that Oakland Airport literally sits on what we believe is landfill in San Francisco Bay. There are some airlines that only fly to Oakland that don't fly to SFO. And for many passengers, it's actually more convenient to fly to Oakland to get to San Francisco. Now that it's connected with that little cable car thingy to BART, you can actually get to San Francisco quicker from Oakland than you can from SFO. I don't know why SFO thinks they have the exclusive rights to use the word San Francisco, but it's interesting. If you go to Google Flights and type in San Francisco, you only get SFO. But if you type Oakland, SFO comes up as well. I think that's a little lopsided. It's something Oakland, I think, rightfully wants to address. But SFO thinks that will cause undue confusion and passengers are too stupid to realize the difference. And maybe they're right with a few. There are some not very smart passengers. But honestly, I think they're biting off more than they can chew here. I say let them do it. You don't own the word San Francisco Bay, do they?
I think it's funny that they're arguing that the name change is illegal.
It's gross. There is a trademark, though. So there is legal basis because San Francisco International is a trademarked name. So they're saying they're infringing, Oakland is infringing on the San Francisco International Airport name, that they can't also say San Francisco in the name of Oakland's airport because it will cause confusion. And honestly, I don't think passengers care if they end up in Oakland. They'll say, oh, okay, I'll get on the same train that I would otherwise, presumably.
I guess the question is, do people think that when they book flights to Chicago and they go to Chicago Midway or they go to Chicago, do you think like that? I don't think people get very confused because the airports have different names.
Yes.
And they have different codes.
They do. Then again, sometimes passengers book a flight out of JFK and they accidentally go to LaGuardia. It happens, but be more careful, I guess, when you're booking flights.
I don't think it's going to move the needle all that much. Okay. Hey, this is a follow-up to something that we talked about on the podcast, many moons ago at this point. But Norse is expanding its route network, and this time they're going in the very, very opposite direction from anything that we've looked at so far. But they hinted at this in the past. They're now flying to Cape Town.
All right. The airline that is definitely not Norwegian is doing something that Norwegian definitely did not do by flying London to Cape Town starting October 28th. And this is London Gatwick, by the way, not Heathrow. It's a very interesting move. I wouldn't have expected this to happen, but apparently they can do an out and back turn without leaving the aircraft in Cape Town for 12 hours or whatever, like a lot of other airlines do. And they're doing it in the winter when tourism might be a little lower and they have the aircraft utilization time to do it. I just personally find it interesting that Norse is doing something that its predecessor did not do. And there's no precedent for it here. It's too bad you can't connect to it from the US because the flight times, you'd end up waiting in London for like 12 hours. And that's not something I think most passengers would do, but that is an interesting move from Norse.
Yeah, I think it'll be one that serves passengers well. I mean, given the price on BA, the price on Virgin, and then the price on Norse being very different.
Yeah, but Norse has probably been to Cape Town. I know they've been to Cape Town before because they stopped on their way to Antarctica.
Maybe that's why they're doing it. They flew down there. They enjoyed it so much. They were like, oh, we should do this on a regular basis.
We should come back. We should do this every day.
There you go. Speaking of 787s, if Norse wanted to pick one up, this might be the place to do it, though I think there are other designs for this particular aircraft. 787-9, MSN 37109, was built in late 2014, delivered on the 2nd of May 2015 from Painfield to Basel in Switzerland, and has sat there from the 2nd of May until the 20th of April 2024, when it was ferried to Kemble in the UK.
What's wrong with it? Is it defective? Did Boeing screw it up? Did the operator go insolvent? What happened?
This was Saudi Arabian operator Calair. So this was, let's see, this was their first 787, and they delivered it directly to Basel, which is a well-known VVIP outfitter. So you've got your Mideast royalty planes go here to get their interiors. Anyone with more money than they know what to do with sends their planes here to be outfitted. And it just sat for nearly a decade. And then they said, we're done with it. And now it's off to Kemble. It's been acquired for possibly parts, possibly to fly again. No one's quite certain exactly why. AJW Group has acquired it, but they confirmed that they have the aircraft and it features an exceptionally low number of hours and cycles.
That is crazy to take delivery of something as large and expensive as a 787-9 and let it sit for 9 years and then decide, we're going to part it out. Like, really? Really?
So we'll see what happens to it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Speaking of parting out, hey, Jason, if you want to take apart an aircraft, normally it happens piece by piece. But if you really want to get rid of an aircraft quickly, what do you do?
if you want to expedite the process, you burn it to the ground, which accidentally happened. I believe this was in Spain last week, where a Cathay Dragon A330 that was in the process of being parted out, because I think it was like 30 years old, caught fire and burned down. Not great for, I'm assuming there were parts on board that aircraft that could have been used in others, or the interior, landing gear, whatever. We'll link in the show notes to the pictures, but it made a great firefighting training.
True.
Good for them. I mean, there were no engines on board this aircraft. I think the landing gear was already detached, so really it was just the fuselage. But hey, the firefighters look like they got some good action.
They got some good training out there. Let's close the show with some well wishes and a couple of things we were wrong about. We're going to say good luck and thanks for all your hard work to Jeffrey Niddle, who is the current chairman and chief executive of Airbus Americas. He is leaving effective June 3rd, and Robin Hayes, the former chief executive of JetBlue Airways, will take over. Jason and I both were a bit surprised by this appointment.
Yeah, Robin Hayes is coming off, I think, like a six-year stint of being CEO of JetBlue, who retired, and I'm air quoting, retired only earlier this year, because the state of JetBlue was not great at his departure. So to see him become the CEO of Airbus Americas, an interesting move. Good luck to him and them. Not what I would have expected, because he retired for health reasons mere months ago, but apparently he's made a miraculous recovery and is the new helm of Airbus Americas. Good for him.
Good for him.
Sure.
And then let's talk about a couple things we were wrong about. This first is Plaza Linhas Aéreas. When we talked about the Pratt & Whitney GTF groundings, there was a comment that they were Azul. They are not Azul, and we apologize.
A comment meaning I said it was Azul. It's not Azul.
I was trying to be nice.
But in context, Azul is also an airline that has GTF issues with its E190, E2 fleet. So, whoops.
So all is well that ends well. They are their own airline. They were founded by Brazilian billionaires to ferry a football team.
Ah, common origin story.
Yeah. The other thing that we wanted to mention is that we mentioned that Southwest pilots don't need to do a walk around between every flight. That actually changed in late 2023 to come into line with all other airlines that we know of, where pilots are now required to do a walk around before each flight of the day.
Not just as opposed to the first flight of the day when they are in command of that aircraft, which raises all sorts of questions of how they missed those two cowlings being opened.
Yes.
But yeah, now we know procedure has changed, but only very recently.
So there you go. So this is episode 265. It's a long one. There was a lot that happened this week. I feel like there's more aviation news coming at us more often recently, but that's okay because we love talking about it. I also thoroughly enjoyed talking with Scott, and I got a sneak preview off microphone about what project he's working on next, and we're absolutely 100% going to have him back when that project is finished. But in the meantime, if you want to win a copy of Scott's book, Hercules, email us at podcast@fr24.com. Even if you don't want to win a copy of Scott's book, email us at podcast@fr24.com. Let us know what you think of the podcast, what you want to see on a future episode, what you want to see more of, less of,
or just say hi.
There you go. I am Ian Pechnik, here as always with
Jason Rabinowitz. Thanks for listening.